So yes, we've come to point five of the 7-point mind training. So we're well over halfway. I think last week I used an aeronautical metaphor, if you remember, those of you who are here, that we'd had a steep takeoff of the first 3 points. And last week we were cruising at a height of 35,000 feet. And we're still cruising on this point. And then we've got 2 more points to go. So we'll be beginning to make our descent next week. And not that the points in the kind of up are any less important, but they're kind of, many of them are consolidations of previous points. So for those of you who haven't been with us during our journey, we are exploring the 7-point mind training teachings, which are a mind training in bodhicitta, in the awakening heart or mind, the mind bent on enlightenment for all sentient beings. And we're exploring a couple of texts, one by Atisha and one by a later disciple of his, Chikawa. So I'm only going to briefly recap this week. I've done quite a lot of recapping. But I'll just mention the 4 points that we've done already so you know where we are. So point number one of the 7-point mind training is called First Training the Preliminaries. So this was reflections on the 4 mind turnings. And those practices are to turn our mind towards the Dharma and to give us a foundation of practice. And then there was a line in the text, one of the texts, which said, having done that, having gained stability, reveal the mystery, if you remember that line. So the first point, training the preliminaries, is to give us stability in our practice, so that on that basis we can reveal the mystery. So that takes us to the second point, the actual practice, train in the 2 bodhicittas. Ultimate and relative bodhicitta. So this is the heart of the 7-point mind train. This is what we're really trying to do. So we had some reflections to enable us to have a glimpse at least, or to point at, or to edge into ultimate bodhicitta, mind, reality itself, mind is reality itself, the mind of wisdom and compassion. And then to express relative bodhicitta, which is expressing the absolute quality, that reality in our daily life, we learnt the practice of Tonglen, taking and sending. So point number 3 was called taking adversity onto the path. So this is the special emphasis of the mind training teachings. So this is not seeing difficulties as difficulties or obstacles as obstacles, but seeing everything as a way to wake up. And the reflections in that section were particularly designed to develop kshanti patience, the perfection of patience. Because we've committed ourselves, we have an aspiration to the bodhicitta, to develop the mind or heart bent on enlightenment for all sentient beings. So any kind of anger or blame or resentment or desire for revenge goes completely against that aspiration. And kshanti or patience is completely lacking in anger, in hatred, in revenge and retaliation. So yeah, taking adversity onto the path. And then last week, the point 4 was practice the 5 powers in life and death. This is the essence of the teachings. So it's a kind of point consolidating and essentializing what we've done so far. In a way, I suppose, taking adversity onto the path, well, you're not always in adversity. I mean, you know, we have lots of difficulties, but you're not always dealing with very difficult things, hopefully. So you also need to practice when things are going well. You need to practice every moment, every day, every week. So the 5 powers were applying practice to all aspects of our life. And that point was reflecting the perfection of vigour or energy. So we were using the fact of habitual karma to apply ourselves to directing our minds in more and more creative directions. So if you remember what they were the power of resolution, so intensity, commitment, resolve. The power of familiarisation, so that you know the methods and the practices really well, so that they come to you spontaneously. The power of the white seed, or accumulation of merit. So as you practice the first 2 powers, you drop more and more positive seeds into your mind stream. The power of abandonment, so you try and free yourselves from unskillful actions, unskillful seeds, unskillful sanskaras. And lastly, the power of aspiration, or the power of prayer. In a way, the power of aspiration and the power of resolution are quite similar, except one is kind of conscious intention, the first one, it's a bit like self-power, isn't it? And the power of aspiration is more, may I develop the mind of wisdom and compassion. It's setting a resolution, but it's setting it in a way, opening yourself to forces beyond yourself. It's got a more devotional feel, so you could say that's expressive of other power. So, yes, so we've done those 4 points to some extent or other. So what happens in point number 5 is that we look back and we see how we're doing. So we've covered enough ground now to have a look back and see how we're doing in our mind training. So this point is sometimes glossed as how to determine the level of mastery achieved through the practice of the mind training. Sometimes it's called yardsticks, just that, or measurements of success, or evaluation, or proficiency. So now we're looking back and trying to evaluate how we're doing in our training. How can we judge our progress? So these points show us how we're doing. And yes, they're often referred to as yardsticks. So a yardstick, I imagine, was a graduated stick which measured a yard against all other sticks. When you look in the thesaurus at yardsticks, you get touchstone, so a stone used to test gold or silver, a benchmark, a mark on a stone, which is also a measurement. So you're measuring something against a standard, aren't you? You've got some kind of reference point, your yardstick, your benchmark, your touchstone. It also says these things are a criterion. So a criterion is a standard by which something is measured or assessed. So we're evaluating, measuring, assessing ourselves in our progress, in our training, in the mind training. So I think you get the gist of this point. So we might not have positive associations with evaluation or assessment, either from being at school, or in work, or family, or in many other situations. So maybe it can sound like critical judgment from others, or maybe that taps into a critical judgment of your own. So I can understand if, you know, you think, oh no, we've got to assess ourselves and judge ourselves, and we've got to have a mind training examination, see how we're doing. So yes, that may be part of our experience. On the other hand, you've probably got examples in your life where we do happily assess our progress. So if we are learning something voluntarily, if we want to train in something voluntarily, it's our choice, it's our intention, it's our purpose. And it could be something quite simple, couldn't it? Like learning to drive, learning a musical instrument, learning a language, a physical training, taking up some kind of physical training, or even trying to lose weight, perhaps. And if we take on something voluntarily, then often we want to know, don't we, how we're doing. It's quite good to have kind of signposts or marks in how we're progressing. So, yeah, I'm sure you've all got positive experience, particularly if it's your choice to learn something. It's good to kind of know how we're doing, how well we're doing, and then if things aren't going well, why is that? Can we sort of change something? Can we change some aspect of that training? So even with that positive association with assessment or evaluation, it's still not always easy to evaluate oneself. It's hard sometimes to get the balance right, isn't it? You can't do it too soon. So if you're trying to learn something, you have to give yourself a chance to learn it. So with spiritual practice, say with meditation, you need to kind of take on a meditation practice, apply yourself to it, and maybe give yourself, I would say, at least 6 months, maybe a year, 18 months, 2 years, and then you can look back and see, well, what effect has that had on me and my life? How's it going? So I think an effective assessment needs faith that something is happening, that you're dropping those kind of good seeds into your mind stream, and you don't rip up the plant too soon. If you're growing a plant, you don't rip it up and see if the roots are growing, do you? Unless it's in water and you can see what the roots are doing. So you have to give yourself time, you have to have patience, you have to have faith in order for you to germinate and grow. So I'm presuming with Dharma practice and with mind training practice, a particular aspect of Dharma practice, that the inspiration to follow the path is yours, your choice. It's what you want to do with your life. So then assessing where we're at, how we're doing, gives us confidence. You know, if we think, well, that's, you know, I really have, I really am less selfish, or I really am more kind, or I really am a bit more generous, then that gives us confidence and that gives us faith. And that allows us to practice more wholeheartedly. So Atisha, in his verse, the fifth point in his rendition of the seven-point mind training, says, "By the gracious Lama's blessings, when everything arises as the antidote to ego clinging, and my mind finds freedom with happiness and confidence, may I take all adverse conditions as the path." So that seemed a little bit reminiscent of point number three, taking adverse conditions onto the path. But here you have the sense that the practice is much more spontaneous than it was in point three. When everything arises as the antidote to ego clinging, my mind finds freedom with happiness and confidence, may I take all adverse circumstances onto the path. So that's his take on this point. Chikawa, who tends to extrapolate things into pithy aphorisms, sayings and slogans, first of all has a little verse which says, one is always accompanied by only joyful thoughts. A reversed attitude indicates a transformation. One is trained if one is capable, though distracted. So then he has four slogans which help us to evaluate how we're doing in our mind training. So the first one is, all teachings have the same goal. The second one is, maintain the chief of the two witnesses. The third one is, always have the support of a joyful mind. And the fourth one is, if you can practice when distracted, you are well trained. So I think that makes a little bit clearer than Atisha's verse what it is we need to do, what it is we're looking at in order to evaluate how we're doing in our mind training. So we need to remember what the mind training is about, of course. So it's about developing bodhicitta, ultimate and relative, the mind of wisdom and compassion, emptiness and compassion. A mind that realises the emptiness of all phenomena, including living beings, and yet is committed to helping those living beings gain freedom. And we've learned from previous points in the mind training that the chief obstacle to our spontaneous expression of wisdom and compassion is our deep-seated misconception and delusion of a permanent, fixed, unchanging self. So that wrong view of self, self-delusion, pride in self and attachment to self, self-grasping and self-centeredness, from which, if acted upon, all pain and suffering comes, because we're living from a delusion, a misconception, rather than from the truth. So obviously, if we're looking at how we're doing in the mind training, we'll expect to see some decrease in our ego clinging and self-centeredness. So again, in looking for signs of progress, we're looking at long-term trends. This is very, very important. We need to have a body of practice behind us, because we know from our own experience that daily practice, weekly practice, even monthly practice goes up and down, doesn't it? So practice isn't linear. Our development isn't linear. Things go up and down. So we need a reasonable period of time to look back and see how we're doing. So you go on retreat, everything's going swimmingly, you know, no ego, great, loving kindness, lots of it. Come off retreat and something happens and it all seems to have disappeared in a flash, doesn't it? Not that it has. Same thing with a meditation, do the metta bhavana, you have a really good meditation, come out of meditation, somebody says something to you. So it's up and down, it's an up and down process, isn't it, spiritual development. So you need this kind of long-term view on yourself. So let's just look at those four slogans. There's only four of them, but I seem to have quite a lot to say anyway about those four points. So all teachings, this is number one of Chikawa's slogans, all teachings have the same goal, intention, aim or purpose. All Dharma has a single purpose. This is quite interesting because there's so many practices, aren't there? So many methods in Buddhism, in the Dharma. It's a very, very rich field. There's so many texts, so many sutras, so many commentaries, so many kinds of meditation. So there's lots and lots and lots that we can engage in. I think that's very good because we need different things at different stages of our practice and we have different temperaments. But sometimes, because there's so much on offer, we can kind of lose track of what it is we're really trying to do. Sometimes it's quite hard to see the wood for the trees, perhaps. So this aphorism gets us right back to the essence of what it is we're trying to do. What is the goal? What is our purpose of all dharmas? To decrease ego clinging or self-grasping or selfishness, to uproot selfishness. So all dharmic teachings, all dharmic methods, all practices have the same goal, whatever school, whatever yana. So this is what we're trying to measure or evaluate. Have we managed to decrease, to some extent or other, our selfishness, our self-centeredness? And when we talked about those atma-kleshas, those poisons of self, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about that they're very, very deep-rooted. They co-arise with ignorance. But nevertheless, we do see their manifestations in daily life, do we not? And there's a saying by one of the Kadampa Lamas, one of the Lamas in Atisha's school. It says, the shedding of the ego is the scale for measuring the practitioner. So this is what this point is about. And also Chikawa says in his verse, a reversed attitude indicates a transformation. So in a reversed attitude, which is the aim of the mind training, ego clinging is no longer the central view or the central way of expressing yourself. You've managed to reverse this attitude to some extent or other, to exchange self and other and care for others like yourself. So it's quite helpful in measuring this, if we're going to measure this in some way, to know how self-grasping, self-centeredness, selfishness manifests in daily life. And I think the Know Your Mind material is very helpful on this. You know, there's a book by Bhante called Know Your Mind, which is a commentary on a Yogacara Abhidharma text, because it's incredibly precise about mental events, both positive and skillful and unskillful. They seem to be less skillful delineated than unskillful, which is interesting. So there's a list of at least 26 unskillful mental states. It's quite interesting when you go into this material because, you know, they're very finely nuanced, they're very subtle. You get the feeling that those guys or women, they really kind of knew the differences between certain mental states. So I'll just give you a quick list of how ego-centeredness might manifest in daily life. So this is the list of mental states. Attachment, anger, arrogance, lack of awareness, doubt, opinionatedness and indignation, resentment, slyness, concealment, spite, jealousy, avarice, deceit, dishonesty, mental inflation, malice, shamelessness, lack of propriety, gloominess, ebullience, lack of trust, laziness, unconcern, forgetfulness, inattentiveness and desultoriness. So you get, you know, if you work with that material, you get to rather more finely tuned than greed, hatred and delusion, which is helpful. So you really get to understand and acknowledge your mental states through the process of mindfulness. Yes, so, you know, last week we talked about when unskillful mental states arise, we need to act quickly. That was the metaphor or the action of tapping the pig on the snout. Do you remember that one? Or cleaning the lamp when it's warm, to act quickly. So I think it's important in this point, this slogan, the first of point five, when we're talking about, you know, overcoming ego clinging, self-grasping, shedding of ego, that we're not trying to destroy ourself with a small s, as it were. I talked about this last week, but I'm going to say it again because I think it's very important. So it's important that we don't fall into nihilism. We don't think about destroying the ego, and we think about, you know, squashing ourselves down and destroying ourself. And Sangha actually makes, as I said before, I think a very clear distinction in his book Wisdom Beyond Words between what he calls the empirical self and the illusory self. So we have an empirical self. We have a locus of experience. This is our base, this is our context, this is our precious human birth. But that locus of experience, that empirical self, arises in dependence on conditions. It's a conditioned self, and it's therefore empty. It's just a process of change. It's just a flow of mental events, thoughts, feelings, imaginations, memories. So yeah, but we have an empirical self. We experience, you know, this is me, that's you. You know, things are going on in me that I experience. This is my empirical self. So we need to understand that, and that that's a process of change, it's a flow of conditioned events, conditioned experience. So we can see the impermanent nature of this flow of mental events, this kind of mind stream. I suppose that the metaphor often uses is a river. So you have a river, and that river has a name. It's kind of got banks, and you know, it expands and contracts depending on the rainfall and so on and so forth. You call it something, and it flows, but it's just a flow of, you know, different water bubbles, different water flowing over different rocks. There's nothing fixed or permanent or essential in that. It's a flow, it's a conditioned flow, an impermanent flow of events, but you know, you experience it. So we can see perhaps the impermanent nature of the empirical self, but deeper than that, we have to go a bit deeper than that into insubstantiality and understand that there's nothing which changes. There's no fixed essence of which just the characteristics change. So the example that Sangharakshita gives in the Three Jewels when he's talking about this, when he's talking about insubstantiality, is the example of a leaf. And we say, don't we, because of the way language is structured, we say the leaf changes in the autumn, end of summer, from green to red. So that's the way we use language, at least in the English language. So we've got a sense of change or impermanence, but the way that language is structured, the way we say that the leaf changes from green to red, is as though there's a leaf, an essence of leaf behind the change, of which the change is a kind of manifestation. And it's not really like that. There is just a process of change. There's just redding and greening, or greening to redding. So what we do is we reify our experience. From that flow of experience, we reify, because we have experience, we reify an I that owns and has that experience. Which the I is just another process, another conditioned event in the flow, as it were, because the I that's experiencing this moment is not the same as the I that's experiencing the next moment. So what we need to do is not abstract an entity apart from the flow. That's the illusory self that owns and has that experience. So we're talking about emptiness and insubstantiality in two ways, really. The empirical self that we experience as me, with this flow of mental events and feelings and thoughts and emotions and memories, is empty because it's conditioned, arises in dependence on conditions. And anything that arises in dependence on conditions is by nature empty, because when those conditions cease, the effect ceases. But this reification of the I that's apart from the experience is illusory. It's empty because it's illusory. It's a delusion, a misconception. It actually doesn't exist at all. It's sometimes said to be like the horns of a rabbit. I leave you with that image. So yes, we're not trying to, when we're trying to overcome selfishness and self-centeredness, we're not trying to kind of overcome our ego in a nihilistic way. I think it's quite interesting that Sangharakshita's approach to this is that he focuses very much on expanding and refining the empirical self. Yes, we have this empirical self, we have this locus of experience, this is our basis, this is our ground of practice. And he often talks about expanding and refining that empirical self through skillful practice, through metta bhavana. You've just done the metta bhavana, you probably felt quite different at the end than you did at the beginning. And he says so that eventually that experience of your empirical self evaporates, as it were, into a higher dimension, the mystery. So he focuses very, very much on the positive expressions of the past, doesn't he? The positive precepts, the positive and spiral nidanas. So all that being said, anyway, the whole purpose of Dharma training and the whole purpose of the mind training is to let go of ego clinging. So we can ask ourselves, after a reasonable length of time of practice, are we more generous? Are we kinder? Are we more compassionate? Maybe it's good to ask it in that kind of positive way, as it were. So how do we do this? So in the mind training, we come on to point number two. Follow the inner witness rather than the outer. Or, of the two witnesses, of the two judges, rely on the principal witness. So this is quite interesting, isn't it? Here you've got the idea there are two witnesses of you, of your process, your practice, your progression, and the suggestion is that we should rely on the inner one, on ourself, rather than on the outer one, which is other people. So that's interesting. Who knows best? Who knows best whether we are less selfish, more generous? Is it other people, or is it us? And I think here, when it's saying don't rely on the two judges, the outer witness, it means not relying on others' estimation of ourselves in a non-helpful way, when we want approval, we want some kind of group approval or acceptance. So it's interesting, a witness is someone who has first-hand knowledge or evidence of an event. It's often referred to as an eyewitness, and it's observer, someone who can bear witness, affirm, confirm, and authenticate. So someone who can is an eyewitness too, can bear witness, affirm, confirm, and authenticate your spiritual progress. So we're looking within, and in a way it's true, isn't it? Only you know really what's going on. Only you know what your motivations and intentions are. We can talk things over with other people, and hopefully we will. We can get feedback from others, from our friends. But only you know really what's going on in the depths of yourself. Well, to some extent you do. So you can pull the wool over other people's eyes, can't you, to some extent? You can put on a good show. Can you pull the wool over your own eyes? Well, you can in a way, but less intentionally, when you've got blind spots. You know, we've all got blind spots and we don't really see ourselves that clearly. But I think the idea is not to look to others for approval, not to the group, even the Buddhist group, in order to please. So you're evaluating yourself on the basis of your own spiritual motivation, based on your aspiration to bodhicitta. But our Sangha, our movement, is very strongly Sangha-based, very strongly community-based, very strong emphasis on spiritual friendship, on friendship, human friendship, and spiritual friendship. So interaction with others is obviously extremely useful, as I'm sure you know. Others do see us as we don't necessarily see ourselves. They see those blind spots, and they very nicely point them out to us, and then we have to take difficulties onto the path because we don't always like it, do we? And they see the good, as it were, the skillful, and sometimes the not so skillful in us. So I think our communication with others is very, very important. So I wouldn't go with relying entirely on the inner witness. I would suggest that we use both. And I think what we're concerned with in this point, the inner witness and the outer witness, is two positive mental events, which you may have heard of, Hri and Apatrapya. So both of these are positive mental events, so the second and third of the 11 positive mental events, and they both arise out of Shraddha, and they're also present in subsequent positive mental events. So Hri is sometimes translated as self-respect. So it's a contact with your own sensitivity, your own conscience, your own ethical sensitivity, arising out of your faith, your Shraddha, in the three jewels, in your spiritual practice. So only you know how you feel and express your own aspiration deep down, and you know how you fall short of that. And that, if you do fall short, that causes you pain, that causes you remorse, genuine remorse. So you have your own standards, as it were, of, you know, how you want to practice, how you want to be, dependent on your faith and aspiration. So it implies very much Hri, implies very much a sense of values. And as the inner witness, it works as your inner witness, it expresses an honest introspection without self-deception. So a very positive mental event, Hri, self-respect. So the second one is Apatrapya, often translated as concern or respect for wise opinion. So your reference point is here outwards. So it's sensitivity to the opinion of others. So it would be the opinion of your spiritual friends, people who share the same values as you, people you trust. It's aroused in relation to someone you have faith in, respect in, and faith that they have your best interests at heart. So if you've done something unskillful and you choose to confess that to your friends, your spiritual friends, you know that they won't say, if it is truly unskillful, they won't say, oh, that's okay, don't worry about it, you know, it's fine. They actually engage with you in perhaps a quite rigorous communication. They'll say, well, you know, how come that, you know, you behaved in that way? You didn't want to behave in that way. How come you behaved in that way? What were the circumstances? You know, what was the conditions, the causes? What mental events were going on? What kind of mental states were you in? How could you avoid it happening again? And we know that this happens with our friends, in our study groups and our mitra groups, if we're in the order and the chapter, you know, you can engage on the basis of your ethical sensitivity and their ethical sensitivity. You can have a really fruitful communication. They won't let you off the hook, but it's in no way judgmental. So that is apatrapia, respect or concern for wise opinion. So these two Korean apatrapia, and in a way they are the inner witness and the outer witness, are crucial. They're sometimes known as the two lokapalas, or protectors of the world, because they're concerned with ethical sensitivity, and without ethical sensitivity there can be no civilization, no culture. So they do have opposites in the unskillful mental state. There's ahrikia, which means you have no sense of values. It's not just that there's merely an absence of a sense of values, but you rejoice in and boast of your unskillfulness. You know that state. We've all done it at times. And anapatrapia is the unskillful counterpart of apatrapia. Means being without scruple. So you don't really care even what your best friends think if you do something unskillful. So they both arise from faith. And it's interesting that Triya and Apatrapia, self-respect and concern for wise opinion, although they're positive mental events, they're painful. It's quite interesting, that, isn't it? Because I think we think that skillful mental states or positive mental states are going to be pleasurable, but these two are positive and painful. And that's because if you feel genuine remorse or regret because you've done something unskillful that isn't in line with your own aspiration, as it were, that's a painful experience, as I'm sure you know. It's a sort of positive painful experience. It's good to have that painful experience. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a conscience and you wouldn't have ethical sensitivity. So free, this inner witness, this self-respect, as it were, is not the negative inner critic. It really is not that. That's probably formed from irrational guilt. And apatrapia is not authority projection. So those are things we have to work with on. In order to really experience genuine free, genuine apatrapia, genuine remorse, being able to kind of positively introspect and positively engage with others on the basis of ethical sensitivity, we have to work with any tendency we might have to irrational guilt and authority projection. And I think just because of our culture, we probably all have to work with that. So remorse and regret, whether in relation to ourselves or in relation to others, are very positive mental events. And again, to go back to Sangharakshita, he often refers to them as expressing what he calls rational guilt. So regret at doing something genuinely unskillful as a, you know, measured against the precepts, as it were, which you need to resolve as soon as possible through acknowledgement and confession. But he also says, even though you need to acknowledge and confess, if you feel that kind of remorse, you also need to let it go and move on. So you don't kind of hang on to that feeling. You find ways of moving on. It's very interesting in a text called Dhyana for Beginners, which I think I did quote from last week. There's a list of things called the 10 signs of sincerity for, you know, to do with unskillful action and how to resolve it. I'm only going to look at the last four, but number six is you make a confession. So if you feel you've been unskillful and you choose to do this, you can confess. You kind of acknowledge and you confess, you open up about it. So you can do that in a puja, you can do it in front of a shrine, or you can do it, which is probably much more powerful in relationship to your spiritual friends. You say that I did this, and you get into that kind of conversation we talked about earlier. So yes, confession is very, very important. But the next point is you break off the current of your thoughts relating to that offence. So once you've confessed and you've talked it over, you let it go. You don't dwell on it in a neurotic way. You don't beat yourself up about it, because then you're falling into that inner critic, as it were. So you break off the current of thoughts relating to the offence. The next point is you take advantage of the protective courage which the Dharma offers. So you recommit yourself in some way. You connect with something positive, with something skillful. You go for refuge. You wish for the emancipation of all sentient beings and renew your vow to help them all. So again, you renew your aspiration. This is what's going to take you forward. And lastly, you keep continually in mind the non-existence of both offence and repentance. So you bring in the perspective of emptiness. So this is just saying it's interesting, and even though it's really important to experience remorse if you've really acted unskillfully. You don't dwell on it longer than you need to. You confess and you move on in a positive way. I mean, it may arise again, you know, it may come back again, or probably will, but nevertheless, these steps are quite helpful, I think. So Sangharakshita contrasts remorse and regret as skillful mental states, which he calls rational guilt, with irrational guilt. And I think we seem to suffer from irrational guilt quite a lot in our culture. So that's when we feel guilty about something that is actually not unskillful, but somewhere or other we've been conditioned to think that it is. So that can be very painful. We can get caught up in very neurotic kind of circular states of mind. You know what irrational guilt feels like. It's really, really unpleasant feeling, isn't it? You go over and over in things and you fear, or sometimes you fear punishment. You feel loss of love and approval. It's a very undermining state of mind. And I said before, if we suffer from irrational guilt, we really need to find ways to resolve that. Through positive practice, through doing the metta bhavana, through helpful friends, through practicing Buddhist ethics. So yes, maintain the chief of the two witnesses. I think we need both witnesses. We need the inner witness. We need that witness of free, the inner witness, self-respect, and we need apatrapia. So we need ethical sensitivity, both in relation to ourself and relationship to others. Both are helpful, both are important, but perhaps in the end, only we know our own motivations and attention. So perhaps we are the primary witness, as it were, into how we're doing in our mind training. So that brings us on to point number three. So what are we looking for in our evaluation of ourselves? Point number three says, rely on mental happiness to assess your progress in the mind training. And it also says, always have the support of a joyful mind. So it's put in two slightly different ways. So rely on mental happiness to assess your progress in the mind training implies that you do need a very positive basis on which to assess yourself. So you need faith, you need commitment, you need metta, you need loving kindness, so that you don't fall into the negative opposites. You don't fall into that inner judgmental critic, and you don't fall into authority projection. So you need mental happiness as a basis, and then it says always have the support of a joyful mind. This is a mark of how you're doing. Always have the support of a joyful mind. So in the spiral path, independence upon reflection on dukkha, it's not just that if you experience dukkha, that's going to lead to faith. You need to reflect on dukkha and unsatisfactoriness. In reflection on dukkha, that leads to faith or shraddha. And as we've said, faith, shraddha, includes kri and apatrapya. It includes those two positive mental events. And that leads to joy or pramodya. And from that follows all the other links on the spiral path. So joy is a very, very important spiritual quality and sometimes said to be the hallmark of the Buddhist practitioner. So joy at this stage of the spiral path, dukkha, shraddha, joy, changing languages, suffering, faith, joy, is described in various commentaries as delight, inner satisfaction, well-being, easy conscience, a clear conscience, you have nothing to reproach yourself with, you're free from remorse, you're cheerful, you're content on the path of virtue, you experience no conflict between your behaviour and your ideals because you're living skillfully and fulfilling your aspiration, you feel in harmony, at peace, you're free from irrational guilt and mental conflict, you also feel at ease with others because you don't need to feel defensive, because you've nothing to hide, you're congruent, you're not inconsistent. So you're confident, you're open, and you have a song on your lips. So that's joy as that third stage on the spiral path. Very, very positive state, mental state, and said to be the hallmark of the Buddhist practitioner. So if you have some kind of experience of that from time to time, now and again, you know that your practice is going well. Also, on the basis of all that, That joy gives you the courage in adversity which you need excuse me, to take difficulties onto the path. So you also have a cheerful equanimity. So I think you can see that joy, you know, this joy, and you're not very far up the spiral path, you haven't gone very far, and yet all this kind of opens out, is very, very dependent on the practice of ethics. Because we're talking about having a clear conscience, you've nothing to reproach yourself with, you're not in any conflict, you're congruent, you're consistent, there isn't a great gap between your ideals and where you are. And sometimes in suttas which explore the positive nidanas, between faith and joy is ethics. So sometimes that's kind of brought out. Between faith and joy is ethics, which includes sri and apatrapia. And sometimes even another mental state is inserted between faith and joy. So you have a kind of whole complex of ethical mental states. A mental state called avipatissara, which means freedom from remorse and confidence in that freedom. And then it's said that intensified and is expressed in joy. So it's though one is the fruit of the other. Joy is the full-blown fruit, as it were, of freedom from remorse. So you could say that joy, as expressed in this link on the spiral path, is our immediate spiritual goal. And as faith is part of all subsequent positive mental states, so joy continues to be experienced as you kind of progress along the path. But that joy gets deeper and fuller. So always have the support of a joyful mind. This is a way of seeing, well, how am I doing in my practice? And it's not that things are going easy all the time. It doesn't mean that. It means that you have some inner resources that are arising that help you to take adversity onto the path. You're a little bit kind of less dependent on positive conditions. Positive conditions are very, very important, but you're a little bit less dependent on because you have the fruit of joy from your ethical practice, from your previous practice. So if that's not the case, if you've lost joy, enthusiasm, zest for the spiritual life, which happens, doesn't it, from time to time, you just kind of lose it, as it were. We need to think, well, okay, I'm not experiencing that at the moment, so what do I need to do? And Jana reminded me recently that I once said to her, apparently, if you can't go forward, you have to go back. I'd forgotten I'd said that. So if you can't go forward, you know, you can't go from joy to rapture to bliss, etc., 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 because, you know, you haven't got that experience of joy in the sense we've described. Then you need to go back, as it? You need to go back and think, well, is there something kind of gnawing away at me that I'm not quite aware of? You know, there is some remorse there, but I'm not really very conscious of it. There is something going on. You know, I'm not that integrated in a way. And that's going to happen, isn't it? As we practice, we get deeper and deeper into our sanskaras, into our habits, into our attitudes, into what we've done in the past that we didn't think that much of at the time. But, you know, in relationship to having relationship with the precepts now, you think that really wasn't very good, and you feel sorry about it now even though you did it a long time ago. So all that goes on in our practice. That's why it's not kind of linear or straightforward. So we need to maybe just go back and as it were, and think, what is going on, why am I not in touch with that joy, and find out. Maybe you need to talk it over with your friends, to confess, you know, explore it in meditation, and also reconnect with your sources of inspiration. So yes, if you can't go forward, go back, as it were. So joy in that sense is very much to do with, it's a fruit of your ethical practice. It's a kind of this feeling of a very clear conscience. It has a very clear feeling about it. And still we're very much in the mundane. We're still on the mundane spiral path. We haven't got very far, as it were, although in some senses we've come quite a long way. It's a very important quality. So joy, of course, can have a more transcendental quality in those upper reaches of the spiral path, post, as it were, knowledge and vision of things as they really are, or if you've touched into absolute bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. And of course, the deeper the source of joy, the less conditioned its source, the more it kind of just flows out of a deeper practice, the less dependent on external conditions it is, the more it will sustain you. So I suppose joy is both a practice and a fruit. It's a fruit of your previous practice, but actually you can cultivate joy. you can, moment by moment, day by day, look for that enjoyment factor in your experience. Look for zest, look for enthusiasm in what you're doing now. And I think in terms of joy, as a practitioner, Minarepa is one of our great examples in the tradition. So Minarepa is someone who had a lot of hardship. He didn't own hardly anything. He lived a very hard and renunciate life up in the mountains. But he's always singing about joys, and he's always expressing his appreciation of his circumstances, the beauty that surrounds him. In one of his songs, I think it's a song of a yogi's joy, he says, "I feel exceeding joy when hardship is great." So this is someone who takes adversity onto the path and feels great joy in that. And there's another story in the Songs of Minarepa where I think it's earlier on in his spiritual path, as it were, where he loses his bowl and robe. So he's only got a bowl and a robe, hasn't got anything else. And I can't remember quite what happens. I think he drops his bowl and it smashes and it's windy and his robe blows away. So he's got absolutely nothing. And he gets very upset. But what he manages to do is to realise that he's upset and say, "Why am I so upset?" So this is quite crucial, isn't it? Because we get upset and we don't necessarily ask ourselves what's going on. We just build on the upsetness, as it were. So why am I so upset? And he's got a lot of practice behind him, so he manages to think, "Oh, it's because of my ego clinging, it's because of me and mine, it's my bowl, it's my robe, and now I don't have it." And, you know, he has a very deep insight into the nature of conditioned existence, into the nature of self at that moment, and he says, and that leads to great joy and freedom. So we may not be able to be like that yet, but we can cultivate joy, zest, enthusiasm in our life, moment by moment, day by day. So how are we doing with that? Do we find it easier to encounter difficulties because we've got this kind of resource within, as it were, of joy? So a friend of mine wrote to me the other day, and it's quite interesting what she said. She's quite an amazing person. She has three small children, two of them really quite small, and she's also chair of her local centre, so she's quite extraordinary. She does a lot. But last year, her life is quite a balancing act. Those of you who are mothers with small children will know. And it was all going very, very well. And then one child goes off to nursery and picks up a bug. And, you know, this goes round and round. And they all fall sick. And, you know, her kind of very careful kind of balanced life, it all kind of falls to bits. And, she found that quite difficult. But anyway, she managed to kind of maintain her practice to some extent. And so she was writing and saying, things are objectively better at the moment. The kids aren't sick and things are going well. And she said, I'm more deeply back in touch with a feeling of flowing from inside, is how she put it. And she says, not that I don't have difficulties, but it's as though all the worries, the pressure, the unsatisfying things that I experience, as though they fall, as it were, on a layer of shraddha, and maybe even onto a layer of kshanti. So I thought that was very, very beautiful and very lovely, particularly as I know her circumstances and conditions. So that's what we're kind of looking for. Yeah. Yes, things go wrong, as though we've built up, you know, a momentum of inner joy and freedom. So always have the support of a joyful mind. So the last point. If you can practice when distracted, you are well trained. Or practicing even when distracted is good training. So this is reminiscent of an earlier point, which was take the unexpected onto the path. Or when the unexpected happens, join it with meditation, particularly the Tonglen practice. And I think you see this more in maybe a teacher's verse when he says, I'll repeat, when everything arises as the antidote to ego clinging and my mind finds freedom with happiness and confidence, may I take all adverse circumstances as the path. Because obviously his practice has become much more spontaneous. So we're distracted by difficulties, we're distracted by inner hindrances, whatever they are in meditation, and we're distracted externally by misfortunes of whatever kind that can kind of derail us or knock us off our spot. So this, I suppose, also goes back to those five powers of last week, perhaps particularly the power of familiarisation. So the more familiar we are with, say, the Tonglen practice, or with the metta practice, or ethical practice, with the slogans of the mind training, whatever happens, our resources are there, ready to meet it. So we're distracted maybe for a moment, but we can come back to our aspiration, to our direction. So if we can do that, the point is saying then we're well trained. The more spontaneous the practice of mind training is, the better our training. So at this point, the mind training is becoming, as it were, second nature. So obviously, this takes time. So we just have to evaluate ourselves gently and kindly. Think, well, you know, is that true? Am I less knocked off my spot, as it were, by things than I was a few years ago, or different things? You know, I'm more resilient. I'm more robust. And I came across a sort of interesting example of this in one of the commentaries on mind training, which I thought was kind of very sort of pertinent, very kind of simple, very one that we probably all have experience of. And the person was saying, it's very easy to put our bodhisattva aspiration into practice when things are going well. So the example they used was going to a station to catch a train. So you do that in London, you know, you have to give quite a lot of time going to Paddington or Euston or something. You know, you have to judge the tubes, and the tube might stop in a tunnel and might break down, and the bus might break down or everything. So you give it lots of time. So if that works and you get to the station on time and the train is there and you've got your bags and someone else is struggling with their bags, you've got the resources, haven't you? You know, you've got the generosity to sort of help somebody else. So what happens if... You know, your tube has been stuck as a tunnel, you get to the station, you've got your bag, the train is, you know, you've got 2 minutes to get on the train. Do you then, is your focus then really sort of, I've got to get myself onto that train, and yeah, okay, that's all right, you might need to do that. You might have a commitment at the other end, but at the expense of other people, you know, when you get a bit kind of like that on the tube or whatever. You know, it's just, you know, daily life, isn't it? But there's a kind of... Yeah, so in that situation, can we kind of take a breath and breathe in someone else's? You know, they're also running for that train, they're struggling, they've got a heavy bag, whatever. Maybe they're a bit older than us, they're struggling more than us. So can we just kind of relax and help somebody else, even when that's a small difficulty for ourselves? So that was quite a good example, actually. So yardsticks, evaluation for training, how to measure our success along the path, as it were. So Chikawa's given us four teachings, four slogans to help us evaluate. So he's reminded us, first of all, that all teachings have the same goal. So all teachings are there to uproot self-centeredness and selfishness. So that's what we need to be looking at. We need to maintain the chief of the two witnesses. And I'm saying, well, let's have both witnesses. Let's introspect creatively without that inner critic or judge, but let's ask our spiritual friends how they think we're doing, because we share the same values and they can be very helpful to us. When you're assessing yourself and you're seeing how you're doing, always have the support of a joyful mind. And anyway, just always have the support of a joyful mind. See that as a mark of spiritual progress. And if you've lost that sense of zest or enthusiasm, well, try and work out what you can do to bring it about again. And if you can practice when distracted, you're well trained. So again, I suppose the mind training, the 7-point mind training, is very much concerned with being able to take adversity onto the path, not letting things knock you off the path. They're all there, all obstacles and difficulties are there to help you practice patience. So this point gives us an opportunity to look back over the previous points and, on the basis of all the positivity generated, to see how we're doing. And that's very much as a basis for further faith. You look back and you think, well, how are my mental poisons doing? Are they a bit less? Have they diminished? Can I apply positive remedies more readily? Is my selfishness a little bit attenuated? Am I more generous, a little bit more patient, a little more compassionate, a little bit kinder? Do I appreciate my conditions and I don't want to waste them? Am I more contented? Is my mind more cheerful and serene? So you can ask yourself those kind of questions. And if the answer to those things is yes, let's hope it is a yes, you know, even if it's a little yes, if it's yes, well, really take that in about yourself. Really appreciate what you've achieved, as it were, that you've really changed and grown, and really stand on that experience. Because we're so often we stand on what's wrong with us, don't we? What's wrong with the world? Really, what's wrong with us? You know, we're not doing that one, and we can't do it, and it's difficult, and it's hard, and you know, that kind of inner critic. So really stand on your positive appraisal of yourself and your own progress and growth. Let that generate more faith, let that generate more joy, because that will allow you to practice more wholeheartedly in the future. Yeah.